Blog Talk Radio. Talk production. Our guest today is Rupert Isaacson. He was born in London to a South African mother and a Zimbabwe father. His book is entitled The Healing Land, The Bushman and the Kalahari Desert. He is also the author of The Horse Boy, which tells the story of his and his wife's journey across Mongolia on horseback to find healing for his autistic son. Please welcome him to the show.
Hi, Rupert. Are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Oh, good.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, thank you for being here. So are you all settled now?
I'm still in the truck, but I'm maybe 7 minutes from home. So we took some horses up to a Christmas party for the Boys and Girls Club with about 60 kids, did some horse painting and so on. So we're just bringing them back home now.
Oh, okay. Are you the one driving?
No, I'm co-pilot.
Oh, good then.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll just carry on then, because you sound pretty
Absolutely.
Good right
Far
now.
Far away.
So.
No, really good.
Okay. All right, so what we'll do is we're going to start at the beginning, which is actually you and your childhood and the stories your mother told. Could you kind of tell us about that?
Sure. Well, as you said when you introduced me, I was born in London, but my mother was South African and my father's from Zimbabwe. And all of their immediate family, so my uncles and aunts, had all moved over to England at the same time. And a lot of their contemporaries and friends who'd all gone to university together down in South Africa and so on. A lot of them were political exiles and getting out of South Africa because of apartheid and so on. So I grew up in this microcosm of African colonial, white African colonial culture, the liberal end of it, but within London. And my parents would speak Afrikaans in the house, and we had this constant procession of relatives from Africa coming through the house, and we would go to Africa as kids quite a lot. But my mother was very concerned that we should know our heritage and know the family stories and know where we came from. And so she brought us up on a diet of stories about Africa, her childhood, our ancestors there, and so on, so that it was very, very alive and present for us as kids. And, of course, the house was full of African objects and so on. And among the stories were often stories of the Bushmen, because the Bushmen have a sort of almost semi-mythical status, really, in Africa, particularly for a lot of white Africans. If you like, they represent the source, the original, before the whites showed up, even before the black cultures got into farming and herding and war and all. So it's a sort of pure life represented by these kind of elusive fairy folk who lived in an area that was so remote you could almost never get there, called the Kalahari. And it was impossible not to be fascinated by this. And it lodged in my mind very firmly. And I sort of had it in the back of my consciousness, you know, from early childhood. One of these days I want to go and find these sort of elusive fairy folk and connect with them and see who they are, because it just sounded so amazing.
And did your mother share your interest in that as well?
Yes, my mother did very much. And, you know, my mother's, our family was interesting in South Africa because some of the family were architects of apartheid and absolutely on the side of evil. And others were in jail fighting against apartheid, sometimes within the same immediate family. But very few of my family have been that deep into the wild, because the Kalahari is still a very inaccessible place now. But 35 years ago, 40 years ago, it was almost impossible to get into. And so it was out of reach for most people, because it required a kind of full-on expedition to get in there, and those are time-consuming and expensive. And yeah. So my mother, I think, had the same fascination and desire, I think, to get back to the source of Africa like that, and communicated that to me. And, of course, in the end, that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah, I love reading that part. We'll go into that even more a little bit later. But So how did you end up making the trip to begin with then, from your desire as a child to adult?
Well, what happened was, obviously, as kids, we were in Africa on and off, you know, quite often. And often in the bush, but not in that deep, 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 you know, remote area. But as I grew older and got into journalism, it was natural for me to gravitate down to Southern Africa to do my stories, because obviously that's where I was connected. I was politically connected. I know a lot of people down there. I have family everywhere. So I could follow up on stories there for the British press, and I did a lot of that. And then one year, it was in 5, I heard of something rather amazing, that a group of Bushmen had popped up in South Africa. And up until then, South Africa was supposed to have no Bushmen left, that they'd all been wiped out, and that you had to go much further up into Botswana, Namibia, those more remote countries to find them. But it turned out there actually had been a group that had survived under apartheid, and that they had been kicked off their ancestral land in the 1970s. They were indeed the last group of Bushmen left in South Africa, and they'd been living by the side of the road for 35 years. And after Mandela got in, under his regime, if you could prove that your people had been relocated, forcibly relocated under apartheid, then you had a pretty good chance of getting that land back. And these guys, from the side of the road, heard about this and managed to find themselves a human rights lawyer who took on the case. And I read a report about this, and I had a gut feeling that somehow my family would be involved, because when I looked at the area where they were, I have a lot of family in that area, and it's a very remote, very sparsely populated area, and
yeah.
My family in that area are not white. And anyone who's not white in that area is Khoisan, i.e. Of sort of a similar bloodline to the Bushmen. And I just had this gut feeling, you know, I bet you that I have a family involvement in this story. So I went out to follow it, and that's sort of where the whole adventure began.
And so your family involvement turned out to be what?
Family involvement turned out to be funkier than I could have thought. It turned out my family were on the wrong side of the story. They were involved, but
yep.
They were the farmers who were trying to block the Bushman land claim, because the Bushman land claim involved a reshuffle of land. When the Bushmen had been kicked off, it wasn't just this area that's now a national park. There was also an area that the government had subsequently moved other non-white sheep farmers onto, and these guys, they were called the Mir, and that's my family, and my non-white family are among that group, and they popped up and said, hey, well, look, we suffered under apartheid too, you know, and now we're going to be kicked off this land? No way. And in there was this one guy who turned out to be a cousin of mine who headed up that group of farmers, and he basically said, if any Bushman shows his face on my land, I will shoot him on sight. And in South Africa, people don't make those sorts of threats lightly. If someone says they're
going
to shoot you, they're probably going to shoot you. It's not like here in Texas where I live, where there's a lot of posturing around people going, if I saw someone on my land, I'd shoot them, blah, 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 but they probably wouldn't. In South Africa, they absolutely will.
Although in Texas, I wouldn't take a lot of chances.
Yeah, it's a murderous culture. And so, you know, he meant it, and this was my cousin, and I was following this story for the British press, because it was history in the making. If the Bushmen won, it would be the first time that any group of hunter gatherers in Southern Africa had managed to score any kind of win since the first whites showed up in the 16th century, and since the first sort of black farmers and herders came in and dispossessed Bushmen sort of way earlier, sort of 2,000-3,000 years ago. So it really was a historic time. And then when the Bushmen themselves found out that I had a family connection to this story, because by then I'd been with them, hanging out and interviewing them and so on for some time, and they knew that I was really committed to this, they said, oh my gosh, well, because you have this family involvement, this is bigger than you, this is something, the ancestor spirits are in control of this process. And so we are going to have to turn this over to a shamanic process, and because the spirits are somehow involved in this. And you said it was your mother who told you these stories when you were a kid. Well, now you've got to bring your mother out. And,
we've got to do a
ceremony with her. And this is how we're going to get our land back. Yeah. And I was like, okay, really? You want me to bring my mother? And they're like, yes, absolutely. And we're going up to find, and they wanted me to take them up to see at this healer, who I had met up in Botswana, the neighboring country, who is renowned for as a very powerful Bushman healer. And we'll talk about in a minute, if you like, the importance of healing in Bushman culture and how prevalent it is.
Before we get too far in, though, I want to backtrack a minute and just establish again the Bushmen and where they lived and how long they had lived there. Just to make
sure. Okay, well, the Bushmen are the ancestors of us all, just to be clear. There is no older living group on the planet than the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert. And Bushmen, by the way, is a pejorative. It was, you know, a designation given to them by white people, which in no way reflected their actual names. And some people say it's more politically correct to call them San or Khoisan. In fact, it isn't. Those are also pejoratives given to them by Bladger. Basically, everybody has taken a big dump all over the Bushmen ever since the coming of herders and farmers into Africa. But long before the Europeans showed up, there has always been a clash between hunting and gathering cultures and farming and herding cultures.
Is that because they're more nomadic?
Intolerant. Not really. It's just purely competition for land. You know, but hunter-gatherers are not really that nomadic. They have seasonal camps within a circular territory that they will move every 3 months. But it's a very conservative culture in terms of they keep to the same territory for thousands and thousands of years, and there has to be some big disaster to make them move. Whereas herders tend to be much more nomadic, take much, much longer journeys in search of pasture. And, of course, farmers, even though they tend to try and stay put, they're always exhausting the land and using up the resources. So their children always have to go and find new places. So you could almost argue that farmers are more nomadic in a weird way than hunters and gatherers, because their children always have to go and look for new land to farm. The farm can only ever be passed on to one or two people. So what happens is when those two cultures collide, the hunter-gatherers almost invariably lose out for a couple of reasons. One is that they're never very numerous, because it doesn't pay economically when you're a hunter and gatherer to overpopulate. You want to live in groups of about 12 to 24 people. And this is also crucial. Hunting and gathering groups do not make war. I'll just repeat that, because this is at the root of this whole story. Hunting and gathering people do not make war. War is an aberrant human behavior that's only been around for about 10,000 years. Since the domestication of plants and animals. Homo sapiens sapiens, us, in other words, has been around much longer. We've been around for at least about 200,000 years. And for that 190,000 years before we began the domestication of plants and animals, everybody was a hunter-gatherer. And war is not part of that culture. There is conflict, but it tends to be individual to individual. There's no organization of one group to go and steal the resources of another group, because there's no need, because there's no overpopulation. As soon as you get into farming and herding, you have to have, it's very labor intensive, you suddenly have to have more humans than the resources can actually support. And that's what creates the problems. So that you're constantly in this position where you're having to, you've got more mouths to feed than you can quite manage, and suddenly everything has to be militarized, and suddenly the rights of women, you know, reproductively and sexually are taken away, because now we have to have as many kids as we can, because it's everything's so labor intensive. And actually, now I need 5 wives, you know, all having a baby every year, because I need to produce as many kids as I can to keep the labor force going. And actually, now, even that's not enough. Now I need to go and take the women and kids from that group over there to farm my fields. And, you know, and you start getting into these, you know, patriarchal, violent, militarized cultures that we think, like our own, that we think are sort of how humans are. And people say, oh, it's just human nature. It's not human nature at all. When, for example, Bush and Cheney took us to war a few years ago, they felt they had to justify it, you know, under moral reasons. Because everybody knows that war is not moral. And,
right.
you know, instead of just saying, hey, guys, it'll be fun. Let's go over there and nick their oil and rape their women and have a laugh because it'll be brilliant, you know. And everyone goes, yeah, let's do it. No, they have to say, oh, it's, you know, there's really good reasons for it. You know, there'll be these, you know, they're a bigger threat to us. And if we don't do it, you know, they're going to take us out and even though it wasn't true.
Right.
And the fact that we even bother with the justice system, if you think about it, if we really were just law of the jungle Vikings by nature, well, why would we bother with the justice system? Why wouldn't we just all prey on each other randomly and think that was perfectly fine, you know?
Right.
But we don't. We know it's not perfectly fine. We know it's aberrant. We know that it's wrong. And the reason we know it's wrong is it's not really part of authentic human behavior. It's an aberration. And it's looking as though we may be in our culture rather getting away from that aberration finally after 10,000 years, which I find rather exciting.
Yes.
And I sort of knew that once you sort of have that knowledge, then I say, oh, wow. So if the Bushmen don't get their land, if they really disappear, then that's the last link with who we truly are gone. So this is actually quite historic. I could be witnessing the end of the original human culture, or I could be witnessing its salvation. Either way, I have to stay with this.
So I'm just so glad that you have eyes that can see something like that and know what's in front of you, because a lot of people see them and they just see people broken down on the side of the road and they go right past, where you actually see them as they are, the healers and human beings that are very important to our society.
Well, I guess, too, for me, remember, it was also personal. It was family. It was, you know... And I felt that I had a bit of a karmic debt to pay, because my family, both white and non-white in Africa, did some very bad things.
Yep.
One of the differences between Africa and, say, the USA is that there was no big waves of immigration. You didn't get tens of millions of people from Europe going over to Africa. So... those that did go, their families tended to stay in one spot, or at least keep records and so on and so on. And remember, I grew up on these stories, so I knew what my family had done. And they had gone in there and dispossessed and raped and killed and helped to dispossess these people. And I felt that maybe I had a bit of a karmic debt to pay, that if I could be of use to redress some of those wrongs that my own family had helped to create, then so much the better.
I can completely understand that, being from the South as well and me being on the opposite side of many of my family's beliefs. It's a very difficult place to be when you're trying to save people that they're trying to destroy.
Exactly. And, you know, and hatred comes from fear, you know.
Yeah.
And... you know, the karmically too, a lot of people fear the retribution of what their culture has done. You know, I mean, to put it less politely, you know, a lot of the whites in the South are afraid of, you know, a black man climbing through the window with a kitchen knife, you know, angry for all the wrongs of the past. And because of that, they must be kept down, you know. And
exactly.
South Africa was a very similar type, you know, people would justify what had happened, and people would say, oh, it wasn't so bad. But deep in their hearts, they knew it was terrible. They knew, and everyone is scared of retribution, really. So that creates fear, and fear creates hatred, and hatred creates dehumanization. And then suddenly you're allowed to kill them and, you know, deny them their rights and so on and so on. And obviously, yes, in America, we've seen this with slavery and, you know, civil rights wasn't that long ago, was it? I mean, it was only...
No,
when I was a boy, really, you know. So, I mean, it's all quite recent, the end of colonial culture. So we're still living with those ghosts, I think, many of us.
Yeah, definitely we're living with those ghosts and trying to prevent new ghosts from being created. Even in my history, I'm related to Andrew Jackson, which was a very brutal man.
Yes.
And my family's, like, so excited by the fact that they're related to him, and I'm going, like, oh, my gosh. That's horrible. Yeah.
Yes, you could politely say, well, he's certainly a historically interesting character.
Oh, I like that.
but you know, the truth of the matter is, white or black, within farming and herding cultures, there isn't much to choose between white and black, other than who's carrying the biggest stick. The cultures are brutal and militarized, and the African cultures that most of the slaves were being bought from in the first place were highly militarized, very, very oppressive cultures, whose own kings and political leaders were very happy to sell them to the slave ships and, you know, practice slavery themselves and warfare and so on and so on. But when you're dealing with people like the Bushmen, who are completely outside of that system, you know, true innocence, and then you realize how resourceful and strong these people are, because if you look at the history of all hunting and gathering groups, it's just a constant history of genocide. Everyone and their dog has tried to kill them repeatedly, relentlessly, in organized fashion over the centuries. So the fact that they're even still there at all is this massive achievement. And then you realize, yeah, and you know what will probably happen is when our civilization crumbles, well, they will still be here, because they're so resourceful, they're so competent, that they can survive by the side of the road for 20, you know, 35 years and not lose their quality of life too badly, despite the alcoholism, despite the abuse, despite the violence. But they kept their culture and they kept their spirit. But that comes down to their spiritual life. That's really what's at the center of this whole story.
Definitely, and I want to get into that, because that's a big piece of it to me, is how they maintain that. And I think what saved them to some degree was how difficult it was to get to them.
To some degree. But then, you know, what's been happening is, over the years, the Kalahari has been becoming more and more accessible. And then finally, in the 70s, diamonds were found in there. And now 80% of the world's diamonds are produced in the Kalahari. And so more massive scale of dispossessions and so on, and roads being cut in there and development and so on. And suddenly, in the last 15 years, we realized we were down to the last Bushman groups to have any kind of traditional culture. And their own governments, by now no longer white governments, their own African governments, going after them just as brutally as the whites had done, dispossessing them just as badly. And same old for the Bushmen. Yet they prevailed. And this is their spiritual life and their shamanic life got harnessed, and this is where the story became really fascinating for me, got harnessed for their political process and their legal process. And suddenly I realized there was no separation between what their shamans and healers were doing and what was going on in the courtroom. And that became freaky as all get out.
Now I bet. But yet fascinating as hell.
Well, what happened was I started realizing how everything in that culture was governed by shamans and healers and an awareness of the spirit world and so on, including really banal things. Like, I remember going out hunting with one guy in the early months that I was there, and I was in an area that was full of elephant, and elephants are quite dangerous if you're running into them on foot a lot. But yet, whenever I was out with the Bushmen, we never would run into elephant. But then I get back to my camp, and there'd be elephants all over my camp. And so I said to one of these guys, you know, how come we never run into elephant when we're out, you know? And he said, well, the healers danced the night before, and they asked the elephant where they're going to be, and then we go the other way. And I went, oh, and I went, what? What did you say? And then he realized that I had no idea, you know, how to process it, so he just changed the subject. And then a little later, I was out hunting again with two groups, with a couple of guys, and we were tracking a very large antelope called a hemsbok, which is a dangerous antelope to hunt because it will hunt you back. And the hemsbok bull was about a kilometer at least ahead of us. We could see it. And there was a fresh dropping on the trail, and the guy who was in charge turned to me and said, okay, senior doctor, pointed himself, senior doctor, he had a little bit of English. And he was standing with our eyes closed, facing backwards down the trail in the same direction that we had come. And then after about 10 breaths, he turned us around and boom, there on the trail, right in front of us, was the hand spot. And not just standing there, but standing broadside on, presenting his shoulder for the arrow. What did you do? How did you, you know? And he said, okay, tonight I'll take you to talk to the healers. And he took me that night to the main healer in the village, and the healer said, oh, I'll show you what I do. And he started pulling out, oh, we use these roots for menstrual cramps, we use this for headaches, we use that for colic, we use, you know, the other, this stuff, you know, if there's problems during childbirth. Da, da, da. But he then said, but you know what? We don't need to use any of this stuff if we have access to a good trance healer. If we have a good trance healer, I'm not a trance healer, but I'm more of a, you know, a plant physician. But if you have access to a good trance healer, you don't actually need to use any of these plants at all. And so I said, well, what's that? Then he said, well, you've been with us for a while now. I have a feeling that pretty soon you're going to get invited to a trance dance and you'll start to see what this is all about. And this is really who we are. And sure enough, about 4 weeks later, I was invited to attend a healing dance, and it was for a woman with rheumatoid arthritis in her legs and massive swellings and in real pain. And a healer came in, and a guy I hadn't met before, and danced himself until he was in a trance. And then he began to, while in that trance, pull at the legs of the woman and literally sort of pull the sickness out of them, and he began to bleed from his nose and his mouth, and great streams of mucus coming out of his nose and mouth, and covered in sweat, and he fainted a couple of times and had to come out of it. And the whole village there clapping and chanting and creating a sort of rhythmic backdrop for him to work against. And then at the end of this very, very long healing, I mean, he must have danced for 12 hours. In the dawn, all the swellings had gone from the woman's legs. And I asked her, you know, are you surprised by it? She said, no, this is my third healing in 3 years. I have to do this every year, otherwise it comes back. But, no, this is how I keep it under control. And
wow.
Then I just started getting exposed to tons of this and seeing people, you know, dancing, the shamans coming in and dancing not just for physical ailments, but also for example, couples who were fighting a lot and whose domestic problems were disrupting the rhythm of the group. And then that's when I realized, oh, they were doing this as part of their land claim process. And what I realized was happening was that the lawyers in the case were coming and briefing the community on how they thought the case had to go. And then the community was going and talking to their shamans once the lawyers had gone. And then the shamans were going into trance and connecting with ancestor spirits and God. I'll sort of talk about ancestor spirits and God in the same breath. Getting a set of instructions, coming back, rebriefing the community, who would then go and rebrief the lawyer. And the lawyer would go into the courtroom with this brief. And I realized that the lawyers were getting briefed straight from the spirit world. And,
wow.
And that we must never let them know this because they wouldn't be at the top of their game. They suspected that, you know,
so the lawyers had no clue
coming.
Where the information was coming from.
But here's the deal. They ended up winning twice the two largest land claims in African history. Absolutely extraordinary. So it was completely successful. And
most of these
and
people don't
effective.
Have any education at all, right?
Some do, some don't, but for the majority, no. You know, they're in remote, but it depends how you define education. I mean, their way of life is, you know, so incredibly rich in every sphere that they find it relatively easy to switch, for example, hats and start living in the Western world and then go back into the bush and so on. Like, we find it very difficult to switch between cultures. They don't at all. They all speak like 10 languages. They all take that stuff for granted. And they're sort of extraordinarily resourceful people. I remember once when my truck broke down and the guy I was with, who's Bushman, lifted up the hood and said, oh, you need to do blah, 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 and blah. And then I said, well, I don't know how to do it. He said, well, have you got tools? And I said, yeah. And so he did it. And he fixed it. And I said, wow, where did you learn to be a mechanic? He said, I've never learned to be any mechanics in my life. So, well, how did you know then? And he said, well, I've watched people when their trucks break down, and I see, and, you know, da, 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 and it's not that difficult. I'm like, okay, I feel very stupid now. You know, so there is this competence in the people that, like, you could take pretty much a bushman straight out of the Kalahari, dump him in the middle of New York City, and come back a year later, he'd be alive. He'd be okay, you know. And because they're just very, very, very good at what they do. And the proof is in the pudding, because if you think about the relentless attempt to wipe these people off the face of the planet that are still going on, yet it's never worked. They're still here. And their culture's still largely intact. And they can absorb any amount of Western or other African culture into their culture without seeming to adulterate their culture too much. And when we're all gone, they'll still be around, you know. And when the skyscrapers fall, the Bushmen will still be there, you know. But it would be nice if things didn't have to be that apocalyptic. And
exactly.
I think that's where we're getting to. I'm an optimist, and I feel that in the course of my life, I've seen some truly miraculous changes happen historically. I've seen the Bushmen win their land claims. I was honored to be part of it. I ended up taking them to the United Nations and the U.S. State Department, and we hired the lawyers for them, and we went and helped them to take the Botswana government to court and won. It was amazing. What a privilege to be part of that. You know, we were one of three organizations that was part of it. I founded my own organization halfway through this process to sort of help with this. And but I've also seen the fall of apartheid. And everyone said that that would come with a civil war, and it didn't. And I saw the Iron Curtain come down in Europe without a civil war. And then we saw the reemergence of war in the Balkans, remember in the 90s when Croatia and Serbia clashed. But they managed to end it without the conflict spreading. And the Velvet Revolutions that preceded it and followed it have stuck and have lasted. And we've seen the first black president, you know, come to America.
Yeah.
And we've seen all sorts of things in the last 60 years since the end of World War II. We've seen the European Union. We've seen the end of 10,000 years of constant tribal warfare in Western Europe that culminated in World War II with the absolute destruction of everything. And we've seen, for the first time in its history, our culture move consciously away from warfare, back towards something that's more really of a set of hunter-gatherer ethics of respect for the individual, respect for women, respect for the environment. And even though it's an uphill struggle, we're much, much, much better off that way than we were 60 years ago. So I do believe that there's some movement afoot here, and it still goes back to the source, these people who are the original people, who somehow hold the candle for all of us.
Let's go back to the park that they were in. Now, they built the park around them. They were already there, right?
Yeah, so they were kicked out of the park. But once they won the first land claim, which was in 1999, that was in South Africa, they were given the right to re-enter the park and take up residence in some parts of it. But it still became very difficult to enforce that because the park themselves were very unwilling to cooperate. And then they also got land outside the park as well. Which is the land that my own family had been disputing. But however, in the years that have passed since 1999, since that land claim was won, the Bushmen have managed to get more and more of a presence within the park and have started their own tourism venture in there and are able to go back in now and gather wild foods, medicines, and do a certain amount of controlled hunting and, you know, reclaim their culture there. And then up in Botswana, where we won the really big land claim, which is to an area called the Central Kalahari Game Reserve, in 2006 was when we won that claim. That area, the Bushmen are completely back, completely re-resident, back on their land. And that's been a wonderful thing.
Now, when your culture has to break apart because you're being moved, because they were moved out of there, and were they placed in like a settlement camp, or where were they placed?
They were placed in South Africa. They just ended up on the side of the road. But in Botswana, they were put in these resettlement camps that were pretty awful places, where they were subject to every kind of abuse you can think of. And there were abuses which were not part of their culture. We talked about war being an aberration of human culture, but
right.
There's another one, which is violence against women. And sexual violence is very much an aberration. And the proof of that pudding was that when rape and sexual abuse began to happen in this resettlement camp, the Bushmen did not have a word for it. And they had to borrow a word from English for rape. So they called it ireti, because they didn't have a word in their own language for this. Because
Wow. This
was just something that would never occur to anybody to do. Because in hunting and gathering societies, women are as powerful as men, they're as economically important as men, because hunting is only important for part of the year, gathering is important the whole year, and these are enlightened people. So they don't have chiefs, they don't have power structures. What they do is they just defer to people's areas of expertise and according to the situation that's at hand, and they run the society through discussion and consent and also the shamanic process and so on. So you don't have patriarchs, trying to keep control and
right, all the power
taking women's reproductive rights away from them and that sort of thing. It's just not part of who they are. So it was very interesting to think, well, is that a myth or are they really like that? And
right. Realizing
no, they have to borrow a word for rape. They have no word in their own language for this. This is extraordinary, And it shows that human beings are much, much better, I think, than
right. We
give ourselves credit for. In terms of our basic nature, we are much more gentle and just than we think we are, because we've had this aberrant 10,000 years since the domestication of plants and animals of behaving like angry teenagers.
Definitely.
But in fact, our culture is... At its root is actually very peaceful, and so it's very humbling when you're around people like that who are enlightened and forgiving and wise and patient in the face of people actively trying to destroy them, and also but competent at the end winning out, they
right.
were not destroyed.
Which is absolutely amazing, considering their resources, which
totally.
Were none, in as far as money and education,
mm-hmm.
it was all very extremely limited.
And it was
and
very,
they
very
did
odd,
it.
For us too, because we were in the field, financing the lawyer in that case, and we fielded that lawyer for about $150,000 of money that we managed to raise here and there. But remember, I said it was a diamonds issue, so.
Right.
De Beers Diamonds basically owns the country of Botswana. And so the government's lawyers, of course, were being paid from those unlimited coffers.
Right.
Unlimited money, Yet our lawyer won. Even in a court where the judges were largely people from the same family groups as the political guys who had kicked the Bushmen out in the first place. And
yeah,
we honestly did not expect to win. We did not expect to win at all. I was as flabbergasted as anybody else. And I only heard about it from the BBC. I was asleep on my couch here in Texas one day. And I got this call. And it said, it's the BBC, blah, blah, blah. Can we have a quote? And I was like, a quote for what? And they said, well, haven't you heard? I'm like, have I heard what? I said, you guys won. You won the land claim. You won the, it's what it is. Because they were 6 hours ahead of us.
Wow.
No idea. So I was like, no way. Okay, well, my official comment is no way. So the journalist went, way.
Yeah, there's nothing more dangerous than resources being discovered on your land.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They will definitely put millions into taking that from you. So to
totally.
Win against that is amazing.
And what the Bushman said was, listen, mine the diamonds by all means. It's a huge area. Put in as many diamond mines as you want. And by the way, you don't have to give us any compensation or anything. Just don't dispossess us. Just don't move us. That's all we ask. Because this area is the size of Switzerland. Yeah. But the government still said, no, we're gonna move you, you know.
Greed is unbelievable sometimes.
It is.
Now,
what
right did they have to even fence in the park to begin with? Because it's like they're trying to protect the animals there, but aren't they the ones that destroyed the animals to begin with? Now they build the park to protect them?
That's certainly the case in most parks. Most parks were created in the 60s and 70s in areas where there were already people living side by side with the animals. But so a lot of game reserves are sort of artificial creations. But this one was the only, this is what made it even funkier, this was the Central California Game Reserve was the only park in Africa that had actually been set aside not for animals but for people.
Wow.
And therefore the animals upon which those people depended in the 1960s. When the British left Botswana, there were a couple of people in that administration who wanted to do something for the Bushmen, because they knew that when the British left, the Botswana tribe, who would promptly take power, would go in and do bad things to the Bushmen, because there's an institutional racism there between the farming cultures and the herding cultures and the hunting and gathering cultures. So they created this area called the Central California Game Reserve to protect those ancestral rights. And then it got enshrined in Botswana law. So what the government did by moving them was completely illegal and completely against their constitution. The area was actually set aside for the Bushmen. And so that was what our legal precedent was, that, you know, guys, look, here's your constitution. It's in paragraph, blah, 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 blah,
yeah,
right there in front of you. It says this land is to be held in perpetuity for the Bushmen, and you have kicked them off. This is completely illegal. You know it. We know it. The world knows it. Come on. Let them go back. And mine as many diamonds as you want, by the way. No one's saying you shouldn't mine diamonds. Just don't kick the people off. Easy. Be nice. You know,
right. Nice?
Why should we be nice? Because to be nice is not to be seen as powerful, you see. We must take a position of power. And once the Bushmen had been cheeky enough to say, actually, chaps, we'd rather not move, then they had to be crushed as an example. But it didn't work. The Bushmen won. And the Botswana government got egg on its face. But they, you know, they're very cross about it even today. And I'm banned from Botswana myself. I can't go back in. There were 16 journalists and human rights workers who had been active in the case. After 2006, the Botswana government announced that all 16 of us would be arrested if we ever went back into the country, which is also completely illegal, but there you go. And including eminent journalists from the BBC, there's a guy called John Simpson, who's probably the best senior foreign correspondent that the BBC has, and they banned him, which is a silly move, you know. Because it shows you got something to hide.
Exactly. Tell me about the cover of your book and how that came to be.
Well, the cover of the book is very interesting because it's a guy who I had met before. When the Bushmen were... when the publishers were looking for the right cover, they sent me sort of all these pictures, and we considered using a picture that I had taken and so on and so on, but publishers being publishers, you know, they were looking for some particular special image. And then they found this one of this guy, and I realized that this was a guy that I had met right at the beginning of my whole adventure with the Bushmen. And there was this random picture of him, and suddenly there he was on the front of the book, beautiful portrait of him, and I thought, oh, I see, yeah, what's at work here, you know, that was this guy in some way sort of watching over me, was this guy,
yep.
Because once you've been around the Bushmen and the healers and the shamans for a bit, then you cease to be surprised at strange coincidences, because you're just
popping out of the bushes. And
totally, you're more surprised if there isn't some strange coincidence,
right?
Because
now,
because it becomes
name?
So normal to you. Say that again.
What was his name?
Oh gosh, it's hard to pronounce in
Now that's not is it Dawood?
David. Well, no, yeah, David is David was a different guy. David was the leader of the group in South Africa, but David just died this year.
Oh.
And one of the postscripts of that book is that most of the people I've worked with in Botswana are okay. They're back on their land. They're doing just fine and so on. But the guys that I worked with in South Africa, almost all of the people who were in that book have now been either murdered or died in violent circumstances. And so even after they won their land claim down in South Africa, the difficulties and the sheer murderous nature of that country, and it is murder. South Africa is a darn dangerous place, and there were people who were very angry with the Bushmen for having won. And,
when you start talking about land and farmers and all, it can get as brutal as.
It can. And
how
so
done it?
Someone caved his head in with a rock, and we have no idea exactly who. And he's the second one I know who was killed that way. You know.
Does that have a significance to be killed that way, or is that just how
he
was killed?
No, I think that probably if somebody was hired to kill him, it's a cheap, easy, and brutal way to do it. You know.
Yeah.
And you surprise somebody in the dark and you smash their head in. You know. And it makes no noise. You know. I'm like a gun. And they
so
can't really fight back.
So amazing how all the signs can take them and protect them in so many different ways.
And
then sometimes it doesn't.
But, you know, his people, David, managed to lead his people home.
Yeah.
And so his legacy to his people has been incredible. That even though they still have all sorts of difficulties and challenges to face. And in South Africa, they really do suffer from alcoholism and the sort of effects of their dispossession process in a way that even up in Botswana they haven't suffered as much. Despite all that, you know, they've managed to sort of hold steady, but you know that it's going to be the next generation that comes in to win the land claim who will probably benefit from it, who will probably be able to heal those dysfunctions within their own group, because
it's very difficult when you take people away and then bring them back and they try to rebuild what was, especially
exactly.
when you've had to use the spouse to other things. And now
exactly.
you bring her back and say, this is your life now. It's hard to get the youth convinced sometimes that that's where they want to be as well.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, even David said this to me a few times. He's quite a wise man. He said, listen, Rupert, you know, our generation, are too messed up. And we're not going to change. The best we can do is to win the land back, get the land back. But that's all we can do. And once I get the land back, I will be, I will sink back down into the bottle, you know, because I know my limitations. I know who I am. I'm weak in that way, and I'm strong in other ways. And that's a very humble thing to say.
Yeah.
And sort of true to his word, that's kind of what he did after he won that landmark case for his people, and he saw his people sort of secure. He did just sort of fall straight off the wagon and disappear into a sea of alcoholism, and you know, but yet he brought his people home. And if you look at this in the sort of long term historical sense, history didn't require David to be a saint. History required David to secure the land for his people, and you know, and he did that, and that was a Herculean effort, you know. So if he then wanted to drink himself silly, you know, afterwards, well, in a way, he'd earned it, hadn't he?
And that's one of the things within your book. You had moments of, like, amazing spiritual energy that's mind-blowing. and then as dysfunctional alcohol fighting and all kind of madness on the other
exactly.
end of the spectrum.
Often within the same 3 hours.
Was in the same car ride.
Yeah. And after a while, you get used to being on that emotional roller coaster.
Right.
And less surprised by it, and therefore less distressed by it. So I found it very difficult in the early days.
So did you have to shift your logic of even how to function in a world? Because, I mean, most of us go, you know, we're going to drive here and we're going to do this. But that's not the way they function at all. Anything could be like, all right, now we're pulling over because we got a sign here and that means this and... And so there is no such thing as a schedule with them, is there?
No, you just have to, I think, the first couple of years that I was with them, I would get frustrated and not terribly because I knew what I was getting into and so on, but I still found it harder to cope with sometimes. But by the time I had been working there for 18 months or so, I had completely shifted my whole expectation, and I realized that what you had to do was think like a hunter-gatherer, that you're always looking for signs, tracks, whether they're spiritual, whether they're actual tracks of animals, whether they're, you know, emotional signs that people are leaving that might tell you something about what decisions they're going to make or blah, 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 blah. And I realized that this is what the bushmen were doing all the time. So when they suddenly make you stop by the side of the road when you're on your way to somewhere, and you're like, no, we're going to be late for the appointment with the law. And they're like, no, we have to get out and follow these leopard tracks. And then it would always turn out that it was the right decision. So after a while, I stopped questioning it. And then it would just be difficult sometimes when I had Westerners out there, like, you know, lawyers or other activists or someone who were coming out with me who had not been through that learning curve. But also what was easy for me was I did grow up partly in Africa. And even
so
among
you
white
had
Africans,
some different
there's a
logic
bit more
to
of that.
Begin with.
Yeah, there's a fair emphasis on following and trusting intuition.
Right.
Because you have to in Africa. You often don't have anything else to go on. You know, think of the countries of South Africa itself. There's 8 official languages there. So even if you spoke 4 of them, you're frequently going to be in a situation in your own culture, in your own country, where you probably don't understand the language, you may not understand the customs, it may be very difficult to make the right, you know, choices. So the only thing you've got to go on is your gut. And so even among whites, my parents, for example, were very good about getting us to cultivate our sense of intuition as kids.
Yeah, I can tell.
And that helps a lot.
It definitely shows on you completely.
Well, I guess my mother taught me well.
She did. Definitely. It's just such a different logic. But if you think about it, we invented time. But to them, why do they need time? What is their hurry to...
This way, logic is... We in the West have this great myth about ourselves that we're these rational people that make all of our decisions through reason. We don't at all. We don't at all. The people make their political decisions absolutely based on emotional reactions. People make their life decisions based on emotional reactions. We fall in love. We can't explain what that is. We get jealous. We get greedy. We get envious. We get afraid, even if we don't need to be. We're constantly making decisions, constantly, based on completely irrational sets of stimuli. And yet we persist in trying to fool ourselves that we are these kind of rational, you know, science-based things. Because even science, any good scientist worth their salt, including, I'll give you an example, my uncle was head of pathology at University College Hospital in London and quite an eminent research oncologist. And he was the first to admit that a lot of Western medicine is based completely on an irrational process, which is the placebo effect, that, you know, when drugs are put on the market, they go through a drug trial. In that drug trial, there's a control group, and that control group gets a placebo. And they don't think they get better on that placebo. They actually get better on that placebo. And nobody can say why. But the entire Western pharmaceutical thing rests upon that. And we don't consider that as consumers because we're not present at the drug trial. Think, oh my God, look,
right.
She got better. She, you know, got a placebo. Wow. You know, we're not there to see it. We're not like at the Bushman's, the shaman's fireside watching the whole process. You know, we just go get a prescription, go buy the thing. So we think it's come through this really rational and completely reasoned
sanitary process of chemicals.
Exactly.
But in reality, it's our mind and our power to heal ourselves that it's activating. That is the pill itself.
Exactly.
Because
the
we
mind
need some outside source to validate our ability to heal ourselves.
Exactly.
Which is a mind-blowing concept.
A lot of us know this, you know, deep down.
Yeah.
We know it's true. But we're afraid. We think that, oh, well, if we allow ourselves to think that way, then our whole world will fall apart. And that won't.
It's kind of like religion
will still run
where
yeah.
everything in religion is, I give my power to God
yeah.
through him. He does his work through me, all of which make us believe that we have no power whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality,
yeah, I mean, religion
is
a strange one. You know, here we are. You know, I was in Ireland doing a training, you know, for my work I do with autistic kids and horses about a week and a half ago, and I was staying at this college, All Hallows College in Dublin, and you know, I drive up to the college grounds, and there's this big crucifix with a suffering man being tortured to death,
right?
You know, life size, semi-erotically, you know, less, you know, and we think it's fine for our kids to see those images, you know.
True.
That's completely irrational. It's completely bonkers. It's completely
brutal,
mad.
Like a man blood dripping,
yeah.
all that.
But
you're
what
like,
if it's familiar,
go worship
so
him.
We don't even think about it anymore because it's just such a familiar image. It's, oh, there's Christ on the cross. Yeah. But when you actually stop and think, well, what is that image of? You're like, my
right.
God, that's horror. That's like a horror movie. It's like a still
really
horror
is.
Movie unfolding. You know, and we let our kids see this, and I'm just nuts. You know.
I know, but yet, no, I can't. My kids can't watch TV, and we go to church instead. But then you hear about all kind of brutal things, and you're like. We're so conditioned that it doesn't mean anything
yeah.
to us, but it does to the children who haven't gone through the conditioning.
Exactly. Yeah. What's weird is most of us know that God exists. I mean, you know, I completely believe in God, completely 100% believe in God. I can't really tell you why, though. And so, I would annoy the Christian conservatives who get very upset by my thinking that, you know, we shouldn't probably be putting pictures of people being tortured to death up in public places, but I also tend to annoy the scientists because if I say, well, I do believe in God actually, but I can't tell you why because guess what, it's beyond my ken. There's stuff I just don't know, and I'm comfortable saying that. You know, I'm comfortable not knowing. How can I possibly know? I don't know how many species of parrot there are in the world either. You know, and the most renowned ornithologist in the world who probably does know every species of parrot would acknowledge there may be some other species of parrot that we have yet to find, you know, that one can never know, one can never truly know on a purely intellectual basis, or that we would like to know. But also, the intellect is only one aspect of life. The intellect is one tool. It's a good tool, but it's a faulty tool. People go mad all the time. People end
exactly.
up on drugged in an institution all the time. You know, the mind doesn't necessarily give one the right answers. And then you have to have another set of tools in the toolbox as well. So, and people think in extremes, oh, well, if I go with the intuition and the gut and the heart, then I can't go with the mind at all. So, well, why can't you do both? You
exactly.
know, and isn't that a considered decision? And I think that's sort of what people like the Bushmen remind us of, because as hunter-gatherers, they have to make decisions based on all manner of moment-to-moment information, some of which is coming through rational stuff, like there are the tracks going that way, da, 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 da. And some of which is from completely irrational stuff, like, I don't want to run into the elephant, so I'm going to ask the healer to dance and find out where the elephants are going to be so I can go the other way and not get killed by elephant. And if there was nothing in this, well, they'd all be dead, wouldn't they? Because they get sick, they all get sick, just like anybody else, and they get better. And this is what they use. So if there was nothing in it, then they'd all have died long ago. But they haven't. They're actually doing quite well. So presumably that the proof's in the pudding there. But then one can easily get into these sort of cultural discussions of, well, is shamanic healing real, or is it complete bollocks, or is it, should it all be about science? But really, all these issues are beside the point, because shamanism does exist. Science also does exist. And lots of people seem to thrive who can find a middle line between those two things, and that's just how the world is. So why even bother, you know, why even worry about it? Why not just get on with the job in hand, which in our case happened to be helping these guys get their land back?
Yeah.
And let's use every tool at our disposal.
I don't see shamanism as two separate things, though. It's all energy to me.
Exactly.
So it is the same thing. It's just we've decided not to explore certain aspects of science, and yet it does exist and is staring us right in the face. We just refuse to explore it.
Yeah, exactly.
But you lived it and you saw it.
Yeah, and it's a process which I think is simply reality, but in an adventure like the one which I was fortunate enough to have, that reality gets played out at a kind of a meta level through loudspeakers.
Yeah.
So you can't ignore it. You know, at a certain point,
everywhere.
You're like, all right, I give it up. I'm.
Yeah. Now, in the book, you talked about, like, I saw, too, on YouTube, a documentary about them, and I was thinking museums can be a very dangerous place because they're writing the history of people, and then the Westerners and all are coming to see that as the true history. But if they alter that story anyway, they can actually rewrite the history of these people with complete lies. So a museum could be a great place, or it can be a very dangerous place. And when you're
Exactly. If the museum or a history book exists to propagate a myth, or if it exists to propagate what actually happens, or what actually it all depends on who's running the country at the time. Yeah. So yes, there was a time in South Africa when they had this myth of all sorts of myths, like when the whites first went up into the center part of South Africa, there were no people up there, that they'd all sort of migrated out, and so when the whites took it over, they weren't dispossessing anybody, they just found all this empty space. It wasn't
right.
True at all, but they produced history books that said so, and they produced museums that said so, but they had produced this system called apartheid to keep white people and black people apart, but black people working for white people at the same time, and that itself was such a huge, weird, strange, and ultimately impossible to continue, system. It was like a hothouse flower. It couldn't thrive in the real world, really, outside of a generation or
right.
two. So you know, now that all those museums that the white government, you know, put up, and so they've all been taken down. They've all been, you know, deconstructed as they should have been. Yes, I mean, history is always told from the point of view of the winners, isn't it? You know,
yes.
We know a lot about what the Romans thought about life, but we don't know much about what the Gauls thought about life, because the Romans destroyed the Gauls. You know, so
exactly.
Stuff we won't know. Yeah, and they burned their history books. Yeah.
The same thing with the tourist industry. Some aspects of it, when I watch it, just make me sick. But then, in some pieces, it's a very important piece for them to be able to make money. So what did you see when you look at the tourist industry?
It all depends, again, who's running the particular company you're talking about. There's really, really, really good tour operators who operate with an absolute conscience, and I would say that a lot of our logistics, the nuts and bolts logistics of trying to get the Bushmen from point A to point B, or where would they stay, or that sort of thing when we were taking them from here to... Often it was really good tour operators who came forward and said, I will give you the vehicles for this, or you guys can stay in my lodge free of charge. Don't worry about it. You know, I believe in what you guys are doing. Blah, blah, blah. And then there were many who have come forward to really try and help indigenous groups take control of their own tourism. It's all about who's got control.
Yeah.
And there's also ones who are completely exploitative. So it's all a matter of, is it a good person or a bad person? But the industry itself, the tourism industry itself, is not a bad thing at all, because it brings people into contact with each other. And ultimately, that's a good thing. If you've got tourists walking around, it's very difficult to put people in concentration camps and shoot them. You know what I mean?
Cause, exactly.
Because people there who will notice and see it and go, hey, that's not good. So tourism can bring a lot of benefits. It can bring money. It can help cultures survive. It can help the ecology. Or it can destroy it. It all depends who's running that particular company and what their agenda is.
Now, what about the missionary people there? What effect did they have on any of this?
Well, this is a tricky one. On the whole, I would say that the effect is negative, because
yeah.
There's a price. Usually a missionary says, I will help you with medicine, or I will help you with employment, or I'll help you with some sort of uplift thing. But there's a price. I'm not doing this completely open-heartedly and unconditionally. You've got to show up at my church and listen to me ram my stuff down your throat every week or every day. And you can't do this and you can't do that, and you've got to live by these rules and da 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 da. And that's oppressive. If they were going in and saying, you know what, guys, we have this thing called Christ, and we love them, and you don't have to do what we do. We're just here to help you. If you'd like to know,
right.
Well, here we are. We're in this church, blah, 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 blah. By all means, come in, and we're happy to talk to you about it. But if you don't feel like it, no worries. Come to the clinic
right.
Anyway. Then that's open-hearted. And there are missionaries out there like that. But not many.
Not many. The majority of them end up making themselves the primary source of food or medicine
exactly.
or some other
and
thing.
And it's like anything else. It's power, isn't it? You know, and I mean,
yeah.
Power corrupts. And if you've got power, whether it's through the church or through money or through a company or through the military or whatever means you get power, it's going to corrupt you. We're only human, right? If you gave me that power, it would be very hard for me not to become corrupted by it. So
right, it is hard.
Why would those people be any different? No, I mean, you know, they're not saints.
Yeah.
You know, and yet they are sort of pretending to be a little bit, and that's what's worrying, because if you start lying to yourself, then that's a slippery slope, isn't it? But there are some good ones out there, but usually the best ones I've found have stopped doing it. They were missionaries for a bit, and then
right.
they realized, you know, we're not really... This isn't really open-hearted. This is
no.
a bit abusive, actually.
And usually
and
the missionaries are connected to something far more brutal, but they don't know it. They're the first ones to come in with the friendly face. But what comes
yeah.
behind them are the people who take the land and all the different
exactly.
things.
But
so they don't know
people.
Who
they're ought to know. They ought to know. And I don't believe that they don't know. I just think they choose not to look at that.
Right.
They, you know, that's a bit like saying, well, I'm driving this car and I hit this guy because I drove at 60 miles an hour through the street and the residential street, and no one told me that you couldn't, you know, that would. He said, "Well,
yeah.
come on, dude, you're in
the
car."
But they still believe that what they're doing is saving their eternal soul, and that
yeah,
justifies
again,
everything.
Of course, but that's a whole other can of worms, and
absolutely.
You know, organized religion is one of the great ills. You know, more people have died because of that than anything else, probably. So, you know.
Now, there was a man in your book that had a vision. I'm not going to try to pronounce his name. It was it David's father?
David's father, Rekotstan. Yeah, Rekotstan.
Can you tell us about that dream?
Well, he wanted to see his people get back on the land, and he died before any of the land claim stuff happened, but he had a vision of it happening when he was a very old man, shortly before his death. And he told the Bushmen sort of really on his deathbed. I've seen this. It's going to happen. You have to do this, 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 and this. Put one foot in front of the other, and the land claim. We will get the land back. This I have seen in a vision, and it absolutely happened. It absolutely panned out, pretty much exactly as he said.
Wow.
And this is something again that you just see time and again. You know, in these indigenous settings, that yes, there are people who if your spiritual life is alive enough, well, you can say his vision means nothing. It was just a vision. Well, yeah, sure, but it came true, didn't it?
Exactly, and that there wasn't any real expectation that it was going to, if you logically think it out, but it didn't
happen.
And it's because they followed the signs and they kept on. And they believed it.
You know what Margaret Mead said? Never believe that a small group of individuals cannot change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has.
I agree with that completely.
You know, and totally
I think
true.
A
totally
small
true.
Group can move a lot if they're consistent in what they're doing.
Absolutely. It's usually how things go. It can happen in a bad way. It can be Hitler and his cronies taking over the Reichstag. That was just a few people, you know. Or it can be in a good way. But that's up to the hearts of the particular people involved. But a small group of individuals, it's always how things happen.
Now, I'm going to kind of go back to you personally and your piece in this story. Because you, watching you in your life, there seems to be a whole movement with your energy that's following you throughout incredible adventures. And what you learned here, you used when your son was born, correct?
Yes, I did.
And because of that, it's opened up a whole world for all kind of people around the world because of what you learned and saw with these people.
Well, I guess so. I mean, at the time when my son was diagnosed with autism in 2004, and of course that was when I was in the middle of helping the Bushmen with this fight to get back to their ancestral land, and so that was the same year that I had to bring a delegation of Bushmen to the United Nations and the U.S. State Department, and some of the guys on that delegation were trained healers in their culture. They met Rowan. And they offered to do some work on him. And I said, sure, because the worst thing that can happen is nothing. It's just prayer.
Right.
Go for it. And to my delight, my son began to lose some of his more obsessive behaviors. And at the same time, I'm also a horseman. We haven't talked about this in the interview, but I'm I'm walking up and down a fence looking at horses right now as I talk to you. I've always been a trainer of horses. And my son learned to speak. He was nonverbal, but he learned to speak sitting in the saddle in front of me. And so when the Bushmen went home from America after we'd done that trip to the UN, etc., I thought, well, okay, he's had this radical and positive reaction to these healers, radical and positive reaction to the horses. Is there a place on the planet that combines these two things? Because it's not Africa. Africa's not a horse culture, really. Yes, it's Mongolia. So I had this gut feeling that I needed to go with my son to Mongolia and ride from healer to healer there, and that if I did that, there would be some good result. And in the effect, that's exactly what happened, and that, as you said earlier, you know, became a film and a book called The Horse Boy. And the results were so amazing that I now run a therapeutic riding center. This is where I'm calling from today, where we work with autism families and also ADD, ADHD, dyslexia, all this other stuff that's neuropsychiatric, with horses and nature, and we get great results. And this has become a bit of a global movement. Now, I have to say, shamanism is not a part of this, unless you take the sort of wider irrational inspiration that caused me to go and do this in the first place.
Right.
I'm very careful not to bring the language of shamanism into this, because
right.
I don't want people to think, oh, well, a shaman's going to cure a kid of autism or something like that. No, 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 no. What they'll do is ameliorate the negative symptoms. There's, and so, but so can work with the horses. So can being out in nature. So can doing a whole lot of other things too.
Yes.
And it's not about cure. It's not about taking the autism away. It's about amelioration. It's about healing. It's about making the negative symptoms so much better that although the autism remains, you now have a very functional autistic kid that can
right.
speak and go to school and lead a productive life and so on and so on.
And the tantrums are more under control. And
exactly. But, you know, what's interesting about shamans, most of the shamans, the true shamans that I know out in areas like the Kalahari or in Mongolia and so on, they exhibit neuropsychiatric symptoms, often to the point where they would be institutionalized if they were in our culture. Schizophrenia,
yep.
adult autism, severe seizures, bipolar disorder, that sort of thing. Yet in their culture, that's regarded as a having sufficient spiritual sensitivity to already so that you already have one foot in the spirit world. So they target those people for training at adolescence as shamans. And so it's regarded, this is very interesting, as a job qualification, not as a disqualification from society.
Exactly.
And if you think about how very practical these people are, they're all about survival. So they don't waste their time with notions simply because they appeal to them on a philosophical level. And they also are not able to waste human resources. If somebody can do something, they do something. Because it's just completely impractical, you know, not to use, because there's no institution to stick people in, you know what I mean?
Right.
So because of that, they're actually much better at using human resources creatively. And it goes back to that rational versus irrational process. And I think that's something I really learned. And with autism, so my attitude to autism is that it's not a problem to be fixed. I now know so many people who've gone on to have productive lives, love lives, careers, and so forth, who are autistic. And it's a question of harnessing what's really good about it and recognizing what's really good about it and having a way of bringing that into the picture instead of treating it as a catastrophe. And that I definitely sort of learned, I think, through
yep.
my experience with the Bushmen and so on, is that if someone tells you something is a catastrophe and you make that assumption, well, then it will be, right?
Exactly.
What if it isn't? And also remember, I'm a journalist at the end of the day, so I'm always looking for the other 50% of the story. It's like, okay, this is a difficult situation. Now let's look for what's good, because it can't all be bad, because nothing ever is. You know, and that's
right. It opens up channels of the mind that most people don't get to ever know about. So, yeah, it has its side effects for sure, but it does open you to things that can blow your mind as well.
Yes, exactly. Now, I'm being called away.
That's fine. We can.
The horses need training, and we're running out of daylight.
That's all right. I was about to wrap up anyway, so that's perfect timing.
But the bottom line here is that, yes, it has, the horse boy thing has weirdly spawned a sort of international movement where we go around the world now giving trainings, very practical trainings, in how to work both with horses and autism and other special needs, and also how to teach academics and so on kinetic learning. They're doing it by using your body and homeschooling and unschooling and all this stuff. And all this has sort of happened progressively and logically from going from one experience to the other since I first made contact with the Bushmen. And I really
exactly.
could say I owe it all to them. I mean, I owe the ability, I think, to see beyond the obvious matter at hand while keeping my awareness on the obvious matter at hand, both at the same time from them, that they are complex thinkers. They are able to think on many different levels. and I saw how successful they were, how competent they were. And I thought,
right.
I should learn from this. You know, these people have a lot to teach. And thank God for all of us that they haven't disappeared from the planet.
Absolutely. Tell us your website before you go.
My website is www.horseboyworld.com. And
thank
if
you.
People go on there, they can find horseboyworld.com. They can find all the stuff that we do with horses and autism, a lot of the stuff about how we've worked with the Bushmen and other indigenous peoples. And also, if people are interested in the stories, the time I spent with the Bushmen, as you said, is in this book, The Healing Land, which you can get off Amazon, or The Horse Boy, you can also get that off Amazon. But I'd rather you got it off my website, because that way the money goes to our charity, which is the Horse Boy Foundation. We
Absolutely.
Do not charge parents for the services that we give here at our place in Texas, in New Trails. So all the local autism families, we serve them for free. So if listeners want to buy a book or a DVD of the movie and they go to horseboyworld.com and go to the shop, that money goes to help the kids come here. So we'd rather give it to that than to Amazon, but you can also get it off Amazon. And you can view the film of The Horse Boy on an instant download from Netflix. You just go on Netflix and go look for The Horse Boy.
Absolutely. That's where I found you. All right. You have a wonderful day, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a great honor, as always. I'm deeply honored that you had me on. Thank you so much.
All right. Bless you and all of you while you figure it all out. Have a good night.
Thank you, and to you too. Good night.
All right.
To have a dream. Feather dream. Fairer hand but no weaker man to cast no stone. You told to comprehend with wisdom to let go of difference, can no understand. A peaceful man, you're not more. Thank you. Peaceful.